Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your diamond and your pearl of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. Listening to Purple Music, that is from the recent Prince 1999 Deluxe Blown Out Box Set Reissue, etc. is one of the unreleased tracks. On this week's episode of Popcast, we are going to get into all Purple business. It's Prince Stravaganza. We're going to talk about the book. We're going to talk about the reissue. I'm going to talk about this extremely sus clothing line I got a press release about. And we're just going to go deep with some Prince message board experts. The table is packed today. It's four people around the table. I'm going to start at my right. It's Naima Cochran. Naima, what's good?
What's good?
Naima, you know Naima from Music Sermon on Twitter, writer for Billboard and Vibe about music and all things culture. Murph.
Popping, what's going on, man?
First of all, I'm not going to get too deep into my Murph feelings right now, but you know, don't. Murph, this is my brother in my heart. I used to work with Murph at Vibe in the mid-2000s. Murph, the actual king of R&B in the building.
You know, I feel a way about you just throwing around terms like the king of R&B.
I'm the king. You work for Jacquees?
I'm the king of everything.
You know, Robert
Barrett
for Brown. I'm sorry.
That's all right. If there is a Bobby Brown of music journalism, it is Keith Murphy.
That's true.
Murph writes.
No crack.
No, that's right. Only the positive aspects. Murph writes for the New York Post, for the Undefeated, ESPN, Esquire, Vibe, etc. If you need an oral history done, Keith Murphy has all the phone numbers. Across the table, Jay Smooth.
Yes, sir.
Rap Twitter Don. Big shout out to Rap Twitter. I see you.
I'm here repping. We'll talk off mic.
We might talk off mic.
We might need to clear the air.
So you know Jay, first of all, Jay in the hip hop side, no one took to the internet faster than Jay did. Just brought back Ill Doctrine Radio. It's on hiphopmusic.com every Saturday. Also, all Prince heads, very serious Prince heads, very important. I remember I reviewed a Prince live concert X amount of years ago, and Murph got at me talking about what he was talking about. They were dragging me on message boards.
Is that the one where you said Prince is not known for his sense of humor?
No, that was you dragging me on Twitter about some other thing I said. To be fair about that particular thing, I had had a long night, and I wrote that on short notice. Finally, to my left, John Prellis, chief pop music critic in the New York Times.
The Don. And we all applaud.
JP, been to Paisley Park with Prince.
Yes.
I've been to Paisley Park, but Prince was not alive. Has anybody else been to Paisley Park with Prince?
No, I have not.
I've been in the same room with him, though. I partied with him, though.
What?
Oh.
Merch is a light flex. Just a light flex. All right, well, we'll come back to that. JP's going to come out here with the deep cuts also. The deep anecdotes, the deep cuts. Actually, let's start with the 1999 reissue, which we listened to a little bit before. We're in kind of the first wave of Prince catalog excavation. And we were just chatting a little bit off mic about does that violate the spirit of a man who is so clearly a perfectionist and was so specific about what he released, when he released it, how he released it? We're now getting, I don't want to say a dumpster full of files, but we're getting all the drafts or various drafts. We're getting unreleased songs. Before we get into whether they're good or bad, to what degree philosophically is this valid or not? Naima, you just had the grimace, so you could start.
Because that's a hard question to answer. I mean, I was one of the people who said that it violates the spirit of who Prince was as an artist, right? But that's because I have a thing about posthumous releases, period. Any artist, beyond a point. Like, if there's a couple of things they were working on, or if there was, like, one finished work that got held back and was never released, like, one or two albums, okay, cool. But when you're, like, Pac, and you have more things that were released after he was dead than when he was alive, then you have frozen the artist in a period of time that they never evolved beyond.
Yep.
And that's my worry with Prince, is that when we start going into the vault for stuff he made in the 80s, and things like that, like, he was an artist who was consistently evolving and changing and growing and doing different things. Like, even when we're talking about the book, he wanted it put in a contract that he could pull the book from shelves if ever he felt like it no longer represented him. So I think that pulling out old stuff that he didn't want to see the light of day is a little bit of a violation. But in this case of reissues...
Although Prince clearly never heard of a photocopier or a camera.
But in this case of reissues of existing work, where what you're finally doing is giving fans easy access to music that they've been passing along forever
trading networks.
That's a little different to me than actually pulling out some, like, never-before-heard, decades-old type situation.
JP,
now,
what's your
I'm on the other side of this because, you know, I just want more.
Right,
exactly.
And the context now is that Prince is gone. You know, we should polish up what he did perfect, but we should also let out what's in the vault. I want to hear it. I'm totally curious.
But there's so much of it.
Well, no, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, if it turns into what they did with Elvis, where, like, Elvis's Patter on Stage album.
Actually, that sounds live. That sounds extremely live.
This is a true thing.
Is that a real thing?
Yes.
Oh, someone get me that for the holidays.
Elvis having fun on stage or some title like that. I mean, when it gets to the barrel scrapings, I don't want it. But so far, I think they've been pretty good. And Purple Music, which we started with, is nuts, is wonderful. I'm so glad it's out there. I mean, it's 11 minutes long. He sings it through twice, so he was probably going to chop it in half and use the best verses or whatever. But the thing just jams all the way through. And I'm very happy to hear the crazy things he was doing on piano, the crazy polytonal nuttiness of it all. And he pulled it out for his last tour.
Right.
I have no idea how it sounded solo on the piano. I want that bootleg, too.
Hit JP on Twitter.
We can hook that up as well.
Okay. Jason, you got the Z-Share file somewhere with all this.
But also, this is the YouTube tutorial. It's like, hey, kids, here's how it was done. Here's how Prince did it on 16 tracks. Here's what he threw out. Here's how he improved it before he put it out.
That's valid.
And this is the problem of the decontextualization, especially in the streaming ecosystem, where, like, there's not notes that come with the reissue.
That's one thing I do wish they had, especially with the previous release of tracks that he made for other people.
Yeah.
Fans like me who have already heard most of these things on bootleg recording,
right,
we understand this is a guide vocal and we're listening accordingly. I think with some of those tracks on that album especially, it would help to set proper expectations.
Right,
for
annotations
like
in a way.
But I think generally I agree with John that they're doing an excellent job of curating. And I come to this from a certain bias. I mean, if releasing unreleased stuff is sacrilege, my ticket to hell is already printed.
Sure.
But I mean, it's amazing for me, having listened to a track like Purple Music for 25 plus years in bootleg form, to hear it in this pristine, properly remastered form is just revelatory. And I'm so happy that so many people who weren't taking the time to dig up bootlegs back in the day and get a new experience that. And I think, like, Prince was never static or predictable in how we looked at things. He was always fluid in how we looked. You know, he was cursing up a storm, then he wasn't cursing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if we're going to respect his choices, even though it makes no sense to me, his choice was not to leave a will and to leave it in the hands of other people, what would be done with this work
really
after he left.
Bugs me out.
Right.
Murph, what's your vibe on the pacing of the rollout of the unreleased material?
I got a little shook early on with the Purple Rain re-release because I felt that it was rushed.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that sonically, they didn't really do a good job remastering that album. All they did was basically turn it up. They just turned the volume up. I think with the 1999 Deluxe, they had to bring it out quick because they know the fans were just pissed.
Yeah.
And they did a great job with this. Like, this is Candyland if you're a Prince fan. Mm-hmm. Like, this is all you ever wanted. You walk in and you see, like, oh, this was based on New Power Generation. This is the same thing as that. Or wow, look, you know, he's in the studio, and I know the backstory when he's doing, you know, this song, and Morris is in the back laughing, and Prince chuckles because he sees Morris. Like, you, as a super fan, you know these things, but then there's stuff that you've never heard. And that's what's crazy to me. And it sounds good. They got the right engineers, people that actually worked with him.
Right.
And I just think that in terms of whether or not it's fair or, you know, fits with his, you know, his doctrine or whatever, hey, man, when you pass away and, like you said, no will, everything's open. But if there's ever an artist that was built for this whole posthumous thing, like if there was ever an artist where you're like you said, Jay, I'm worried about, you know, the Elvis, I am not worried about that with Prince, because this man woke up in the morning, I've spoke to all of his collaborators, engineers, and he literally had a cot in his studio. And he would just wake up, do the track, go to sleep, brush his teeth, eat breakfast. Like, this man was manic.
Yeah.
So I'm not worried about scraps or, you know, scraping a barrel. This is better than a lot of artists' new
finished
stuff.
Work.
Right.
True.
Absolutely.
So I'm not worried about
that. And also, I mean, look, this obviously comes up with author archives. This comes up with, you know, this is not a unique problem in the music business.
Right.
But I do think the historical record ultimately sort of outweighs unstated individual concerns. If he had stated, never do this, set it on fire, okay. But unstated, maybe he knew. There's a telling thing, and we'll get to the book, but there's a telling bit towards the end of the intro of the book where they talk about being let into Paisley Park, the author, the editor, being let into Paisley Park after Prince has passed with the, I guess, the executors of his estate or the stewards, whatever the legal
term is.
Yeah,
Troy Carter, all those guys.
Yeah. And finding that Prince had kind of just left things in a very, for a guy who was kind of like, the past doesn't matter. But actually, here's like a sheaf of lyrics, like all perfectly lined up. And everything is completely preserved and basically designed to be received for posterity. So maybe what Prince said his belief was about permanence versus impermanence, maybe he had his own conflicting views about it.
That's true. But I guess the other thing is that the whole, and that's just what all of this is about like the mystery and mythology of Prince and the whole idea that every, even passive Prince fans knew there was this vault, like this sacred, secret vault. Like you imagine it looking like, you know, going to the vault. It, what is it in Harry Potter? Gringotts vault. You know,
it's out of my depth.
Just nerded out
right.
on it
like, yeah, a little bit.
I love it.
But you imagine it being like this impenetrable place that just has rows and rows. I used to work with a woman who worked at Paisley Park, and she would talk. It was, I think she might even have been the person that Prince said went on TV saying it was her God-given duty to protect the vault. But she used to talk about like her job of keeping the music cataloged, and I just imagine it's like this infinite space of music. And I think there's just something about the idea of being able to access that completely unfettered, unchallenged, with no parameters that scares me a little, right?
Who is the steward now?
Well, Troy, bank.
Yeah, with the bank, but Troy Carter is the guy that goes around now and understands what the release. He's like the entertainment person, so he's making the
high level calls.
He's Michael Jackson's John Branca, basically. Like
got
John
it.
Branca does that for the estate. He's doing that for Prince's estate.
And he's got an archivist named Michael Howe.
Yeah, Howe is important
who
one too.
Who must know every note on every track?
No, Howe is a nutcase. Like he's like when you when
in a good
you
way.
Listen, yeah,
he's
in a good
deep
way, in a good
he's
way. Like he's like the symbol, you know, literal symbols are supposed to go here, and it. You know, he knows his stuff.
So we talked a little bit about Purple Music. What else in the 1999 Long Tail stuff really jumped out at you?
I think the acoustic piano stuff jumps out at me, like the International Lover jumps out because it's different from the original. And you can hear that he understands how ridiculously funny it is.
Mm-hmm.
Like when you listen to this actual song,
yeah.
It's cheeky. it's like eye winking.
Yeah.
Like, you know that, you know, like, is Prince for real? Like, yeah, you're thinking, yeah, like, and he's in the studio. No, he's not for real.
Mm-hmm.
He's
right,
like,
right,
he's like messing with you. He's like, I know this is hilarious. I know it's sexy.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's hilarious. I'm having fun with this. Also, there's another song that's like really funky.
Rearrange, maybe?
Yeah, Rearrange. I'm like, why didn't you release this? Mm. Like, what is, like, and that's Prince. Like, that man had heat. This is why I don't really get into the whole thing of, you know, scraping a barrel. He had heat.
So let's actually listen to both the 1999 deluxe version, piano version of International Lover, side by side with a little bit of the pumped up, just so we can get a flavor of what Murph's talking about.
Darling, it appears to me you could use a date tonight. A body that'll do you right. Am I qualified yet? This body here is free tonight. Ooh, you're very on first class flight. My plane's parked right outside, baby. Don't you wanna go for a ride?
There's a quote from Prince when he was talking about the making of 1999, where he said, "Yeah, I wasn't planning for this to be a double album, but I just kept writing."
Yeah.
And that was, Prince was just in the lab churning things,
sure,
out at a rate where you couldn't possibly release that much music.
Right.
So, yeah, release schedules, like, not,
well,
for our
younger
listeners.
Well, he was already releasing an album a year.
Right.
Right.
Which was during a period when a lot of people released an album a year, but even when most people started moving to an album every 2 or 3 years, Prince was still putting out an album a year.
But clearly was producing at
and
a much higher rate.
And of songs in the vault.
Yeah, so for someone like that, the percentage of barrel scrapings to stuff that I finished, but no one can put that much stuff out, is in a good direction.
Sure,
and
sure.
Also, you got to look at the fact that he's doing these side projects at the same time.
Sure, mm-hmm. Right.
Like the whole 1990, the magic of 19, I hate using magic because I know you didn't like
that.
I did not
magic.
Like that.
But the whole beauty.
It's a Michael,
I know,
word.
Right?
The a Michael whole, word.
It's a whole Michael word.
Is that what he said? Did he say that?
He said it's a Michael word.
Yeah, my oral history, my MJ Prince. Talk about that another time. But when you listen to that album, just know that he was doing the Times album,
right,
and doing Vanity Six's album, mm-hmm, and then writing stuff for other people on the side, Kenny Rogers, all this craziness, right? But he's doing all this, and this is what I'm saying, like, that man was crazy in a good way.
Mm-hmm.
Creatively crazy.
So when you put it in context like that, and you see how quality 1999 is,
yeah,
and he's giving songs to the time. He's giving 7, 7, 7, 93, 11 to
which
the time.
Which is still one of the tightest songs of
it's
all
crazy
time.
And he's,
oh,
like,
my God,
you can have it, Morris.
Yeah.
You go ahead and have it. I'm going to have this, mm-hmm, little red Corvette. I'm going to do this uber pop 1999 thing about the apocalypse and people dying. You're going to dance to it. That man, it's that era to me is his greatest era.
Agreed.
Yeah. The scale of this particular reissue is pretty vast and deep. Do you think that every era of Prince is going to merit this depth of reissue attention?
Well, I mean, he started putting out triple albums, so I suspect,
well, yeah, okay.
I suspect this, you know, by the time you get
I don't know if the 2000s stuff.
Yeah, I don't know if we need a Graffiti Bridge reissue.
That's my question.
A long play.
I would like to see what's in there, though.
Yeah,
I think there's going to be treats, but that's when this curation hand needs to be strong. Once
right.
he's figuring out his awkward relationship with hip-hop and so on,
yeah,
someone needs to filter things properly, but I'm sure there's gems there, too.
Although the Diamonds and Pearls era is going to be interesting because that's when he captures his black audiences back. And
it's a very commercial... R&B type
very,
era
and,
for him,
and,
yeah.
And some of those songs might have been leftovers from the early 80s.
Yes.
Right. We don't know.
Right.
Yes. Fair. But I remember, like, kind of thinking, like, Crystal Ball era,
Like, I remember I was at Trace at that time. And anybody know Smokey?
Smokey Fontaine.
He's a head for sure.
Yeah, no, I remember Smokey at the time just being like, Crystal Ball. He'd be walking around the office screaming, Crystal Ball. And I was like, really, dog? Like, is that, yeah, is it that deep? I don't know, dog.
The track, Chrissy, this is how Prince is kind of, he trolls people, right? Because if you're talking about Crystal Ball, you're gonna talk about the revolution era stuff, right? That stuff is insanely great. Mm-hmm. What he did was, he was like, yeah, it's Crystal Ball, and I'm going to have all these other songs in there. And people thought it was going to be the Revolution Parade era of Crystal Ball. Mm-hmm. That's what Smokey was going crazy over.
Sure.
So he kind of trolls people in that way. Like, I know what you want. I'm not going to give it to you.
Yeah. Let's pivot for a second to talk about this book. So there's a book. It's called The Beautiful Ones. It came out a couple weeks ago. This is basically the, I don't want to say the detritus, but it is the kind of like hard pivot, kind of cobbled together ephemera and a couple of essays that we have because the memoir that Prince was beginning to work on with Dan Peppenbrink, who is the author, obviously never came to fruition because of Prince's death. Have you guys had a chance to flip through this at all? Obviously, it's beautiful to see all this stuff, but I couldn't kind of tell the difference between this and like a Rizzoli book.
They did with what they could with what they had.
Yeah.
I'm kind of touched by the early first-person Prince essays in there. I did not know he had epileptic seizures when he was a child that disappeared. You get into his mind a little bit there, and you wish, you know, he'd gotten past his adolescence in what he got to write down. But the book feels kind of thin.
I thought the introduction was actually the most interesting part of the book because it's the story of being around Prince.
Yeah.
Right? Which to me is almost more interesting than hearing from Prince firsthand, even though part of the weirdness of it is hearing Prince talk about himself. Like, I grew up, and I guess everybody, well, except for you, JP, but we all were of an age where, like, in the 80s, Prince didn't talk.
Right.
He didn't do interviews. He didn't talk. So even like in the 90s, watching him like present at the BET Awards, I was like, what is that?
It's weird, right?
It was so weird to see Prince just like be at a game or just be on stage at the Grammys or just do an interview and just be
just
normal.
Right.
I don't think I ever really wrapped my mind all around that Prince. And even like the memes and gives a Prince now, I still am not really used to it. So it is still weird for me to hear of Prince's first-person stories, but everybody who knew him would say the weird things about him were that, A, he was sometimes insanely normal, and B, he was so funny. Like you said, Keith, he trolls. He knew that people thought he was weird and mysterious, so he would play on that.
Right.
Right, on purpose.
Yeah, you're playing, you know? That you play to your advantage.
Exactly. Yeah. So that, I think, but I think this book confirms a lot of that while still, because he died before he was able to get far in it, keeps that same air of mystery that he was apparently hoping to dispel.
I can't think of a more apt moment in this episode to talk to John Perales about being Prince. Oh, my God.
Yeah, well.
JP, you interviewed Prince?
Twice.
Woo!
In 1996 and 2004. So 1996 was when Emancipation came out and the glyph was put back in the box and Prince reemerged. And then 2004 was a new deal where he did Musicology, one of the triple albums.
Let's listen to Musicology, a strong title song from a very strong later Prince record.
Don't stop dancing.
This podcast is supported by the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective organization of atheists and agnostics, working to keep state and church separate. Phone 1-800-335-4021, 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. I have been trying to understand changes in migration. So I traveled with photographer Federico Rios to the Darien Gap, this hot, mountainous, 70-mile stretch of jungle straddling the border of Colombia and Panama.
We're hiking through a river, just like covered in mud.
Many used to think that this route was impassable, but thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the Darien, almost all in the hopes of making it to the United States. We spent 9 days hiking through the gap and weeks building trust and relationships with migrants, with smugglers, with migration authorities to even be able to do this reporting. We interviewed hundreds of people who have made this journey to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths to find a new life. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
So the first time, 1996, mm-hmm. I get the Paisley Park tour.
And you'd never met him. I never met him.
No.
You've written about Prince for
I'd
decades.
Seen him. Well, it was 1996.
A decade and a half. Okay, fair.
I may also have actually assigned the first major magazine review of his debut album.
Is it Stone?
Back at Crawdaddy.
Oh, Crawdaddy.
We reviewed for you because I was blown away by this kid. I assigned it, though. I didn't write it, so I can't take Karamanica of flexing.
Who among us?
But anyway. So 1996, we go to Paisley Park. One of the rooms is his costume room, mm-hmm. which is all of these, shall we say, skimpy, shall we say, shiny. And so 2004, he has fully embraced his Jehovah's Witness again. He's reading the Bible. So the costume room where all these like racy costumes were is now the Bible study room. But the thing is, you know, you say he was insanely normal. He was not normal. He was like the most energetic being I have ever met. He was a space alien who happened to be from Planet Music. He was not in any way normal. I mean, I've talked to a lot of stars and most of them are fairly normal in some ways, but Prince was just like energy was coursing through him. A conversation with him was like hyperlinks everywhere in all directions at all times. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I look at the quotes I got from him and they were incredibly straight, articulate, true to who he was. Both times we ended up talking about how compulsively he liked to record. And he said, if you could do this every day, wouldn't you? And he went back in the studio. And the second time in 2004 I came in, he was laying down a drum track. I was interrupting a recording session to do the interview. It's like that's what he did. I just feel like he was this conduit for all these musical ideas. And, you know, you talked about how he was so well archived.
Yeah.
One thing that strikes me on the 1999 reissue is he didn't let a good idea go. The Possessed on 1999... on the 1999 reissue, sounds like a Time song.
Yes.
The Possessed on the Purple Rain reissue, which was 2 years later, sounds like this crazy computerized Prince song. Mm. It's like he knew there was a nugget there and he knew he could rework it. Energetic, bright-eyed, thoughtful, self-aware, funny, compulsive being.
Did you get the sense that he enjoyed being interviewed? Or do you think that he took the occasion of interviews as basically just a platform
another
to say what he was? Yeah, yeah. Like, did he thrill to the kind of give and take?
Yeah, he paid attention. He wasn't delivering statements. We were talking about, I think this was the first one, I think this was Emancipation, where he was independently distributing it. And, you know, I said, you know, it's more difficult with independent distribution. You know, the majors, remember when they were majors?
Yes.
Right. I mean, wow. You know, the majors have this whole network of warehouses.
Should we explain what that means?
Oh, yeah.
Listen, kids, once upon a time.
Oh, you know, man.
But the majors had the distribution network locked down.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, they have fleets of trucks. And he goes, I can drive a truck. And I just imagine Prince jumping into his semi with like 10,000 copies of Emancipation and like selling them out of the trunk.
But I think he probably actually seriously considered doing it. I mean, but what I think you touched on that's important is that you said he was self-aware. And a lot of artists of Prince's stature, I'm thinking about a certain one right now. I'm thinking about Kanye Omari West. I mean, he's not Prince's stature, but you know what I mean? Just like a superstar. He has there's zero self-awareness. And it does seem like Prince was at all times contemplating who he was and the role he played. And maybe it's a pre-Warner legal dispute, post-Warner legal dispute thing, because he was so much more conscious of his impact in teaching other artists and creatives about how to preserve their work, maintain their work, and racial implications, et cetera. But he did seem very conscious of not just how his work impacted his fans, but how his work impacted other creatives.
And JC, you touched on, you know, what we liked about the book, what we didn't.
Yeah.
What I liked about it was you saw the inside of Prince the Race Man.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
And you see how when he's talked about, I used to love the white Superman. And you kind of put two and two together of why early on he kind of distanced himself from his blackness in the early 80s. Mm-hmm. How he tried to be very, like, you know, I'm not going to really put it out there. And then something happens. Something happens around the early 90s where he's like, you know, I don't know about this. I don't know if these people got my back. I'm going to make this R&B album. These fake fans just jumped off my tip. You know, they love the whole Purple Rain thing, but they're not really real fans. I got to remember who my real fans were. My real fans were the white weirdos and black folks.
Right.
So he did that. And that's when the Race Man starts coming. That's when you start working with Spike Lee. He's giving money for the Malcolm X movie. He's talking about putting slave on his, like, he's, and this is when he starts talking.
Totally fair.
And he's talking about, and he's talking about race.
Yeah.
Jay, what was your vibe on the book?
I mean, I think it's a matter of expectations,
right?
Like John said, and I think the rest of you have echoed. I was reluctant to pick. I actually bought the book on the way here to make sure I could give an informed impression. And I've been avoiding it because it just feels like such a poignant reminder of him leaving before he was finished.
Yeah, and you, and when we were messaging a couple days ago, you acknowledged the emotional challenge.
Yeah, I mean, picking up the book and seeing how big the book is and how little of it is what Prince had written.
Yeah. Right.
It was painful to me as someone who loved him so much, knowing that, and having read his co-writers recounting of everything that Prince imagined the memoir could be. And seeing all these other, like, there are these white pages that are what he wrote and all these black pages that are what everyone else has filled in. And I was afraid to sort of, it's sort of another stage of, acknowledging that he's gone.
Right. Although we were talking just before we started recording about how comfortable would you have been with a super revealing Prince book?
Right.
Because obviously, no matter how much Prince had altered his public profile and had been more forward-facing, open-hearted, outspoken, he's still Prince. He still lives
in a
museum.
If he had been ready to do that on his own terms,
I'd
be ready to accept it. But what I'm grateful for is that this book is not speculative. It gives us what he had written so far, and it doesn't try to fill in the blanks.
Right.
And I think that even given, like, all of the aspirations he had for the book, clearly he could not do all the things he wanted this book to do in one book. Like, he wanted the book to solve racism. He wanted the book to teach people how to put out their own music. Mm-hmm. He wanted the book to teach people how to be creatives. He wanted the book to be his story. He wanted the book to be about his mama. Like, it wasn't going to be all of those things, right? So I think that even in whatever Prince would have stayed involved in to create, it still would have been like, what the hell is he talking? Like, there still would have been like
enough
some princeness in there.
Maybe it would have been a triple
book. Where you're trying to
connect
the dots.
Right.
You know, because then he would have, then he wanted to do like a Willy Wonka golden ticket and hide something in the book. Like, you know, what? who knows what would have come around it. It still would have had princeness on it.
It's a very Prince book, though.
Right.
That's what I like about it. He's still keeping a mystery. You're still wondering how it felt if he would have gave the whole story about his parents. Like, he gave good stories about his parents. You finally see why he became this, you know, insulated guy that wanted to take care of himself.
Right.
He didn't think anybody else could take care of him. That's the Prince mythos right there. That's right. How he became Prince. He's like, I'm a control freak, not because I'm a control freak, because I can't depend on anybody else.
Right. I wonder, to sort of think a little bit more broadly about the Prince influence and the kind of long tail of his influence. We could spend a lot of time thinking about specific musical through lines, and that's all fine. But the thing that you just said, Murph, really stands out to me, because I think over the last 5 to 10 years, you see more and more young musicians who songwrite, produce, they keep very close circles. Mm-hmm. They have a very narrow set of collaborators. You know, when you think of the kind of maximalist pop of the 2000s, the early 2010s, you're thinking 20 collaborators, songwriters, producers, engineers, etc. But I think with the immediacy of the internet and kids making music in their house or in their bedroom with their friend or by themselves, you're starting to see a return to this kind of all-in-one thing. And I think when I think about Prince, I think about that self-sufficiency. And I think about how the legacy of that self-sufficiency, what we're seeing today, is knowingly or unknowingly really part of a template that he helped set.
I think it's unknowingly, because he even kind of touched on that. The author mentioned in his intro that Prince would be frustrated with the artist that he was compared to, and I think a lot of times it was based on vocal range instead of based on business acumen or talent or, you know, this person writes, produces, etc. And he didn't understand why he was compared to certain people and not other people. So, like, when you talk about self-containment, like, I think of, for example, a J. Cole.
Yes.
Right? And Dreamville. But I don't think if you ask Cole, he would say, oh, I look to Prince.
No.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
I think he would
agree.
Just be like, oh, you know, it was the mixtape era and I was able to do that. And I don't think enough people really understand how much of a stand it was when Prince did the artist formerly known as when he broke with Warner. I don't think now it's really, you really get the magnitude of what that meant for an artist of that stature.
All the gestures.
Now you can do it on your laptop.
Right.
Yeah. Prince had to have a home studio and keep his engineer up all night.
Exactly.
Right.
And the technology was so different, and he did it anyway. But the whole into the bunker to make my album, mm-hmm. You're right, John, it has come around again completely.
It's weird because, like, all the gestures that were, like, radical gestures when Prince did them are, like, basically, like, memes now, you know?
Yeah,
Like platinum with no feature, you know?
Right,
it's like,
right.
When Prince did it, it was like, what? That seems impossible. And now it's just, like, almost like, lol.
It's funny to me, and you, brilliant that you brought up the whole Warner Brothers thing and him. When the whole Taylor Swift thing came out, I was like, my head exploded.
I'm crazy. It's that I'm not the one speaking Taylor the Swift's name on Bobcast this week.
My head exploded, not because I'm siding with her or whatever,
right?
But because people that were like, oh, poor Taylor. I'm like, you know what Prince, what happened with Prince?
Exactly.
And the stand that he took, and people were calling him the craziest, you're destroying your career.
Yeah.
You're writing slave on your, how dare you? We're going to drum you out of the music industry. And he took his stand. And when you see what happened with Taylor, it's like, I wonder if these kids understand that Prince really.
They don't. Because it became part of his whatever. It's like, oh, he was weird, so he started going by a symbol. No, that's not why he started going by a symbol. You know what I mean? It's just they don't really. I mean, but JP, you could really speak to that more than anybody, I would think.
Well, I mean, but even before that, his first album, when he was he still a teenager?
Yeah, he was like 17. Yeah. Yeah.
18.
His first album, he demanded artistic control.
Right.
I mean, there was always that line, you know, written, played, and produced by Prince.
Right.
That was his stand. And, you know, you brought up the control freak, nobody to depend on. I mean, there's something in the book where he does an interview where he says, you know, if I play every part, I know I'll play it with all the joy that I can bring to every instrument.
Let's actually listen to something off of that first Prince record. Let's listen to Soft and Wet from For You.
Oh, it's a lie you take. You're just too wet.
I don't know if it was Prince's line or if he got it from somewhere, but he would say, if you don't own the masters, the master owns you.
Right.
I mean, and kids get exploited, though. I mean, Taylor Swift.
And she's like Sojourner Truth right now.
Yeah. Right.
Which is ridiculous.
This is my 100% issue with all things Taylor Swift. I think it's funny because if you ask kids today about conversations about masters and stuff, they'll probably quote Jay-Z or somebody and be like, they taught me about my masters. And it's like, no, I'd never heard about music masters before Prince, and I come from a music family. You know, I didn't even know what all of the, I didn't even really understand what all the hubbub was about.
I mean,
right?
The conversation that Prince had with Nas, there's a famous picture of Prince and Nas sitting down together at some event. Mm-hmm. And he asked Nas, like, what did you talk about? You know, did you talk about lyrics and did he like your music? He was like, yeah. He talked about masters.
Yeah, sure.
And he was like, after that conversation, I'm like, I'm doing it all wrong.
Yeah.
Like, and Jay got the same thing from him. Like, this master stuff is crazy.
He was on a mission with that, though. Like, he really wanted to teach young creatives like how to take control of their IP, you know, and of their music
catalog,
of everything. Like, he was really trying to flip, like, he was trying to destroy the system. Like, he was trying to flip the whole industry on his head.
He's trying to fix it, though.
Well, I mean, fix it, but by dismantling it.
Yeah, other people.
I actually, one of the interviews I did with him, we ended up talking about Robert Johnson and how the posthumous Robert Johnson album created the blues revival and the Rolling Stones, et cetera.
Exactly.
Et cetera.
But he said Robert Johnson never made a penny from those recordings. They should never have come out.
Mm-hmm.
I, being the person who wants the vault open, disagree. He was very firm in his feeling that, you know, musicians don't get compensated or credited, then somebody else should not get the profits.
Right.
This is maybe a JP question, because I think the four of us over here are roughly in the same age group.
You're young whippersnappers.
Yes. So we grew up with Prince as an accepted part of the pop firmament.
Right.
You didn't second guess Prince's belonging, his aesthetic. You were just like, well, this is a famous person, and that's what a famous person does, looks like, and sounds like.
Right.
JP, I said with affection, you were there at the beginning. You saw it happen. How radical was Prince compared to what was around at the time? And how much pushback was there against his radicalism?
Well, pushback first. Those of you may remember the Parents Music Resource Center.
Tipper Gore.
Darlin' Nikki was on there.
Yeah.
Their Dirty 30 list or whatever it was called. So there was definitely pushback. I mean, you have to remember, late 70s, punk was happening, hip-hop was happening, you know, things were churning, disco was happening. There was no lack of either sexy or angry music.
Mm-hmm.
But Prince made it so tight and snappy. But when Dirty Mind came out, some jaws did drop, and not just for the beautiful graphic of the bed springs on the cover. There was pushback. There was like, whoa, this is pretty raunchy. Because it was in such a neat pop package, it wasn't punks in basements screaming, and it wasn't a Dolomite record.
Right.
You know? It was aimed at your impressionable pop ears.
The thing what Prince did is that he made things dirty that other people did that wasn't dirty, right? Like, he shows up in his bikini kind of thing.
And a trench coat.
A couple of years before that, P-Funk was doing that. They had diapers and stuff. And that. Oh, that's just comical. That's just, you know, the eye winking. No, Prince did it. He's wearing a flasher's coat. He's doing it to, like, look, man, I'm out here in these streets. Like, I have women in my limo with camisoles on. Like, I'm wearing high heels, and I love women. But do I really love women?
You know, or do I love everybody?
Or do I love everybody? Like, he's messing with you totally, and he has white folks in his band.
Yeah.
And he has black folks in his band.
So,
like, you're, like, getting pulled everywhere, and he's singing about head. Like, this is, like, not normal stuff.
So JP, I have a question. I know in the beginning there was a comparison of Prince and Rick James, because everybody knows about the Prince and Michael rivalry, but there was the Prince and Rick James rivalry at first. Were you guys looking at it like that? Like, from the music journalism and the music spectator world, like, Prince and Rick James are out here doing the same thing? Or was, because Rick James was in the pop pocket at that point as well.
Yeah.
Doing kind of the same kind of thing, like, I'm out here with high heels and crazy hair and crazy outfits.
Rick James seemed more contrived.
Yeah,
it's
I can agree with that.
You know, Prince was doing it from his heart and other body parts. But Rick James just seemed like, you know, this is going to get me attention. Prince to me was by far the deeper artist.
Murph, can you talk a little bit about Prince and Michael?
Yeah, well, some years ago, I had the pleasure of doing an oral history for Vibe, Prince versus Michael Jackson. And I think what a lot of people were, like, taken aback about is that they were actually cool with each other, but they were cool in a way that two panthers are cool with each other.
It's kind of like Tom and Jerry to me.
Yeah, it is. Well, it turns into Tom and Jerry by the early to mid-80s when Mike is saying to himself, I can't be what you are.
Right.
Right. I can't be that. Like, it's not in me. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to embarrass you at this James Brown concert. Mm-hmm. I'm going to come on stage. And I'm going to hit all James's moves because at this point, you're the rock star.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I'm going to be the Chitlin' Circuit kid that I grew up being. Because I can be the pop star. But let me give you a little of this Chitlin' and see these black folks go crazy when I twirl. Prince never forgot that. He never forgot being embarrassed. I mean, him knocking down the Manson. There's a whole, you know, he's playing a guitar and there's a left-handed guitar. All these little things happen to him at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Walks off. One of the early Revolution members, before they became the Revolution, was like, oh, he's real mad now. He really did it to himself now.
Mm.
Right? So when I did this oral history, it's just about how they both jabbed at each other with the whole bad thing, you know. You know, he's like, oh, you know, go ahead and make that song. It'll be a hit. Without, and then he's telling Winnie and Lisa, did you hear that trash? Like, like that's the type of...
And Prince says, the song is, the lyric is, your butt is mine. Who are you singing that to?
Yeah. Right,
you know, I'm not singing that to me.
So he's having that. But the most interesting part of their relationship is when they're both having their somber nosedive career, you know, what's going to happen to me moment, right?
Mm.
And they both kind of like, Michael's calling him up, hey, let's finally do something. And Prince is like, Mike, are you serious? And he kept saying that to him. Are you serious? You know, and Mike was like, yeah, I'm really serious about it. No. Are you serious?
Right.
And that's their relationship. Magic, musician.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Entertainer, musician. Global behemoth. I want to be Frank Zappa. Like, this is the whole thing. And this is why they loved each other. But they also looked at each other as like, threats, because they knew that they couldn't do what the other person could do.
What interests me about Prince and Michael is that I always got the sense that almost everything Michael did was for public consumption and almost everything Prince did was for his own.
Right.
Like his own, like, right. Entertainment. Like, even
it was
if,
a scratch at his own.
Yeah,
itch.
Even if you don't rock with this, I rock with this.
Right,
I
right.
don't care. Whereas Michael would be like, well, that third person in the second row didn't really, you know, mess with it. And I think that drove Michael slightly crazy. And people would tell me, people who had private audiences with both of them, if Michael knew you knew Prince, Michael was going to ask you about Prince. Because he was like kind of obsessed with what Prince might be doing, what Prince might be working on. So this went on until like Michael was almost, you know, until not too long before Michael died.
That whole God quote, the God quote, like I can't
go to sleep because God will take my ideas from me and give them to Prince.
Wow. Yeah, I've always...
Like, it was really that, right? Like, Prince was that much in Michael's head, and I seriously doubt Michael was that much in Prince's head.
Before we wrap up, I do want to talk about something that I know at least two people at the table know a lot about, maybe more. But there's a particular nature of Prince fandom on the internet.
You could say that.
Yes.
So, message boards,
Prince.org,
et cetera. So, I am not as schooled in that. I would like to hear about that.
I'm not that level Prince fan. So let's let Jay
and Murph talk to me about Prince fandom on the internet.
That's part of the dichotomy between him and Michael Jackson is Michael wanted the most love from the most people.
Mm-hmm.
He needed to use his art to fill a hole where Prince had a fire within him he needed to release.
Yeah.
And whoever gets it is going to get it. And those are going to be my people. Those are my fans that I call my
family.
They
will find me.
So
those people will find me.
He was cultivating a relationship with, instead of, a billion, you know, 5 or 10 million, 100,000, however many who really get it, but we have that deep relationship.
Right.
And I was definitely amongst those hardcore fans.
And that's very well suited for internet fandom. We have the thing that you have to remember about internet fandom, because there used to be other kinds as opposed to now.
Internet fandom is
it's very symbiotic.
Yes.
It rewards mutual intensity. It rewards intensity of the famous person feeding people or offering things in the world, and it rewards the intensity of the fan, the listener, the acolyte, giving, absorbing, and giving back.
Right, which I think was something that was conflicting for Prince, because he came online and saw that there were all these intense worlds that were devoted to studying him and speculating, critiquing, loving his stuff, which I think he loved to see, but he did not love having no control
no
over
control.
It. And I think you saw a process over years of him at first trying to send a cease and desist to everyone who's discussing Prince without Prince being in control of it. Then he starts building his own websites where, okay, you can talk about me, but you have to do it under my roof where I'm curating all of that. And I think it evolved over the years towards a pretty healthy space where there are these gathering places like Prince.org where Prince is lurking and checking things out.
And I really respected that Prince himself would drop in every once in a while with a little comment or would tweet something that seemed cryptic, but that was directly towards his fans.
Right.
I like that he eased up on some of the... I like that he wasn't taking himself so seriously that he couldn't do that.
I think it should not be surprising that Prince and David Bowie got the internet before anybody else.
Yeah. Mm.
Mm-hmm. I think when you really look to me, those guys are like polar opposites of each other, but they kind of thrived on the same thing. And when he understood, hey, I can sell this music online.
Yeah.
Like, I don't need Warner Brothers. I'm going to, and people are calling him crazy. Nobody's going to, you know, do that. And he sells like 300,000 copies of an album online, when back then it's a triple album.
Yeah.
So it's like $45 or something. How much did that album cost?
It was 30? Very expensive.
So you do the math. And he's like, I made more money from just this one album than I did from some of my biggest albums.
And I think when you look back to how he was building his identity and brand in the early 80s, like you said, he understood the concepts of clickbait and trolling.
Exactly.
30 years before the rest of us. So once he finally had a Twitter account, you could see
it was over. He was built for Twitter.
Right.
Like, this is like the cryptic, weird way he would spell words and the short abbreviation of things. Like, he is Twitter.
Text speak.
Yeah, he invented text speak before. Yeah.
Like, and he's perfect for that. So I just, you know, that just blew me away of how he adapted when he kind of hated the internet earlier. He finally adapted.
Is there another wild song from the 1999 reissue that we should listen to before we go out?
Well, you were talking about him loving everybody. Maybe we should play Vagina.
Half boy, half girl, best of both worlds.
Y'all said it. Pedro's gonna play it.
Vagina was half boy, half girl. Her hair was shorter than mine. She told me she lived in the city. I never knew that she was lying. I saw her in a gay bar, kissing another girl. I told her, baby, I'm looking for a turn on. Welcome to my world.
That is our show. Thank you, Naima Cochran, Keith Murphy, Jay Smooth, John Pareles. Listen to every podcast ever, nytimes.com/podcast. Email us your Prince memories. Email us about this absurd Prince clothing line.
Oh, we didn't even get into that.
We didn't even get into that. There is a terrible Prince clothing line. Maybe Troy Carter will smite me for saying so, but this is, you know.
I don't think Prince would be cool.
No, probably not.
Not that.
But I guess if you like Victorian era purple overcoats, maybe it's the jam for you. Anyway, if you have any thoughts on Prince and Prince's legacy, podcast@nytimes.com, and subscribe to Podcast anywhere you get your audio content, Pandora, Google Play, Stitcher, iTunes, etc. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We will be back next week.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries, plus napkins, plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this, plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, Essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.